This is Audible.
A History of the English-Speaking Peoples by Winston Churchill. Read by Christian Rodsker. Volume 4. The Great Democracies. Preface. The downfall of Napoleon in 1815 left Britain in unchallenged dominion over a large portion of the globe. France, and indeed the whole continent of Europe, was exhausted. A united Germany had not yet arisen, and Italy still lay in fragments. Russia was withdrawing from Western Europe. The Spanish and Portuguese people were busy in their peninsula and in their tropical possessions overseas. In the following decades, revolution and civil war smote many of the powers of Europe, and new nations were born. Britain alone escaped almost unscathed from these years of unrest. There was an unparalleled expansion of the English-speaking peoples both by birth and emigration. The break between Britain and America made by the American Revolution was neither complete nor final. Intercourse continued and grew across the Atlantic. While America devoted her energies to the settlement of half the North American continent, Britain began to occupy and develop many vacant portions of the globe. The Royal Navy maintained an impartial rule over the oceans, which shielded both communities from the rivalry and interference of the Old World. The colonization of Australia and New Zealand, and the acquisition of South Africa in the decline of Holland, created the new and wider British Empire, still based upon sea power and comprising a fifth of the human race, over which Queen Victoria, in the longest reign of British history, presided. In this period, moral issues arising from Christian ethics became prominent. The slave trade, from which Britain had so shamelessly profited in the past, was suppressed by the Royal Navy. By a terrible internal struggle, at the cost of nearly a million lives, slavery was extirpated from the United States. Above all, the Union was preserved. The 19th century was a period of purposeful, progressive, enlightened, tolerant civilization. The stir in the world arising from the French Revolution, added to the Industrial Revolution unleashed by the steam engine and many key inventions, led inexorably to the Democratic Age. The franchise was extended steadily in all the Western states of Europe, as it had been in America, until it became practically universal. The aristocracy, who'd guided for centuries the advance of Britain, was merged in the rising mass of the nation. In the United States, the party system and the money power, which knew no class distinctions, preserved the structure of society during the economic development of the American continent. At the same time, the new British Empire, or Commonwealth of Nations, was based upon government by consent and the voluntary association of autonomous states under the Crown. At the death of Queen Victoria, it might well have been believed that the problems of past centuries were far on the high road to gradual solution. But meanwhile in Europe, the mighty strength of the Teutonic race, hitherto baffled by division or cramped in lingering medieval systems, began to assert itself with volcanic energy. In the struggle that ensued, Great Britain and the United States were to fight for the first time side by side in a common cause. Winston Spencer Churchill, Chartwell, Westerham, Kent, February the 10th, 1957. Book 10. Recovery and Reform. Chapter 1. The Victory Peace. After a generation of warfare, peace had come to Europe in the summer of 1815. It was to be a long peace, disturbed by civil commotions and local campaigns, but flaring into no major blaze until the era of German expansion succeeded the age of French predominance. In the revolutionary and Napoleonic struggles, Britain had played an heroic part. The task that had united and preoccupied her people was now at last accomplished. Henceforth, they could bend their energies to developing the great resources of industrial and commercial skill which had accumulated in the island during the past half century and been tested and sharpened by 22 years of war. But the busy world of trade and manufacture, and the needs and aspirations of the mass of men, women, and children who toiled in its service, were beyond the grasp of the country's leading statesmen on the morrow of Waterloo. The English political scene succumbed to stagnation. The Tories, as we may call them, though not all would have acknowledged the name, were firmly in power. They'd won the struggle against Napoleon with the support of a war cabinet drawn largely from their own party. They embodied the tradition of resistance to the principles of revolutionary France and the aggressive might of the Napoleonic Empire. Throughout the country, they had innumerable allies among men of substance and independent mind, who would have scorned to wear a party label, but nevertheless shared the prevailing Tory outlook. They regarded themselves as the defenders not only of the island, but of the almost bloodless aristocratic settlement achieved by the Revolution of 1688. Under the shock of the French Terror, the English governing classes had closed their minds and their ranks to change. Prolonged exertions had worn out the nation. Convalescence lasted until 1830. The principal figures in the government were Lord Liverpool, Lord Castlereagh, and, after 1818, the Duke of Wellington. Castlereagh and Wellington towered above their colleagues. Much of the credit for the broad peace which Europe enjoyed after the fall of Napoleon was due to the robust common sense and shrewd judgment of Wellington, and to the aloof disinterestedness of Castlereagh. In spite of many setbacks and some military blunders, these men had led the country to victory. Liverpool was the son of Charles Jenkinson, organizer of government patronage under George III and close colleague of the younger Pitt. He was a man of conciliatory temper, a mild chief, and an easy colleague. He'd held a variety of public offices almost continuously since the start of the war with France. In 1812, he became Prime Minister, and for 15 years presided over the affairs of the realm with tact, patience, and laxity. Castlereagh has served his political apprenticeship as Chief Secretary for Ireland. In the difficult days of the negotiation for union with Ireland, when the powers of patronage were extensively used, he had seen 18th-century jobbery at its worst. He had joined the wartime cabinet as Secretary for War, but was obliged to resign after a celebrated quarrel with his colleague Canning, which led to a duel between them on Putney Heath. In 1812, Castlereagh had returned to the government and had been appointed to the Foreign Office. He was the architect of the coalition which gained the final victory, and one of the principal authors of the Treaties of Peace. For home affairs he cared little, and he was unable to expound his far-sighted foreign policy with the eloquence that it deserved. Castlereagh was no orator. His cool, collected temperament was stiffened with disdain. He thought it beneath him to inform the public frankly of the government's plans and measures. Nevertheless, he was leader of the House of Commons. Seldom has that office been filled by a man with fewer natural qualifications for it. In Wellington, all men acknowledged the illustrious general who had met and beaten Napoleon. His conception of politics was simple. He wished to unite all parties and imbue them with the duty of preserving the existing order. The rest of the cabinet were Tories of the deepest dye, such as the Lord Chancellor, Eldon, Addington, now Viscount Sidmouth, once Prime Minister and now at the Home Office, and Earl Bathurst, Colonial Secretary, whom Lord Rosebery has described as one of those strange children of our political system who fill the most dazzling offices with the most complete obscurity. These men had begun their political life under the threat of world revolution. Their sole aim in politics was an unyielding defence of the system they'd always known. Their minds were rigid, and scarcely capable of grasping the changes pending in English society. They were the upholders of the landed interest in government, of the Protestant ascendancy in Ireland, and of Anglicanism at home. Castlereagh was a specialist in foreign, and Wellington in military affairs. The others were plain Tory politicians, resolved to do as little as possible, as well as they could. They had many advantages. The sea power, the financial strength, and the tenacity of Britain had defeated Napoleon. In the summer of 1815, Britain and Castlereagh stood at the head of Europe, and upon the terms of the European settlement now to be concluded, the peace of generations depended. The sundered or twisted relations between the leading states must be replaced by an ordered system. France must be rendered harmless for the future. An international structure must be raised high above the battlefields of nations, of theories, and of class. The treaties which created the new Europe involved Britain in obligations she'd never assumed before. She was a party to the settlement of the new frontiers of France, which deprived the restored Bourbons of what is now the Saarland and of parts of Savoy. France was reduced to the frontiers of 1789, and Prussia established as the chief power upon the River Rhine. The Allied army of occupation in northeastern France, which included 30,000 British troops out of 150,000 men, was commanded by the Duke of Wellington. Although Tory opinion, even in the day of triumph, was fearful of continental commitments, Castlereagh resolved that Britain should not abandon the position of authority she'd won during the war. Immune from popular passions, race hatreds, or any desire to trample on a fallen enemy, he foresaw the day when France would be as necessary to the balance of Europe and to the interests of Britain as Prussia, Austria, and Russia. With Wellington, he stood between France and her vindictive foes. Unrestrained, Prussia, Austria, and Russia would have divided between them the states of Germany, imposed a harsh peace upon France, and fought each other over the partition of Poland. The moderating influence of Britain was the foundation of the peace of Europe. In the 18th century, the European powers had no regular organization for consulting each other, and little conception of their common interests. The revolution in France had united them against the common danger, and they were now determined to remain together to prevent a further outbreak. An alliance of the four great powers already existed, sworn to confer, as occasion demanded, upon the problems of Europe. This was now supplemented by a holy alliance between the three autocratic rulers on the continent, the emperors of Russia and Austria, and the King of Prussia. Its main purpose was to intervene in any part of Europe where revolution appeared, and in the name of legitimacy, instantly to suppress it. This made small appeal to Castlereagh. He was opposed to any interference in the affairs of sovereign states, however small and whatever liberal complexions their governments might assume. Although caricatured as a reactionary at home, he was no friend to continental despotism. To him, the Quadruple Alliance and the Congress at Vienna were merely pieces of diplomatic machinery for discussing European problems. On the other hand, the Austrian Chancellor Metternich and his colleagues regarded them as instruments for preserving the existing order. This divergence between the great powers was in part due to the fact that Britain had a parliamentary government which represented, however imperfectly, a nation. Castlereagh's European colleagues were the servants of absolute monarchs. Britain was a world power whose strength lay in her ranging commerce and in her command of the seas. Her trade flourished and multiplied, independently of the reigning ideas in Europe. Moreover, her governing classes, long accustomed to public debate, did not share the absolutist dreams that inspired, and deluded, the courts of the autocrats. In spite of these differences, the Congress of Vienna stands as a monument to the success of classical diplomacy. The intricacies of its negotiations were immense. No fewer than 27 separate agreements were concluded during the first 6 months of 1815, in addition to the formidable final act of the Congress itself, and some 20 other treaties signed elsewhere in the same period. Talleyrand, with his background of double-dealing and treachery to his emperor, nevertheless displayed an unswerving and ingenious determination to restore his country's position in Europe. But to modernize, Castlereagh was preeminent as the genius of the conference. He reconciled opposing views, and his modest expectation that peace might be ensured for 7 years was fulfilled more than fivefold. He represented, with its faults and virtues, the equable, detached, and balanced approach to continental affairs that was to characterise the best of British foreign policy for nearly a century. After the Congress was concluded, split became inevitable, but Castlereagh achieved at least one triumph before the eventual collapse. Within 3 years of the signing of the peace treaty, British troops had evacuated French territory, the war indemnity had been paid, and France was received as a respectable nation into the European Congress. Wellington, released from military duties in France, thereupon entered the cabinet in the not inappropriate office of Master General of the Ordnance. At home, the government were faced with the delicate and perplexing task of economic reconstruction. For this, their members were supremely unfitted. The dislocation caused by the end of the war, and the novel problems posed by the advance of industry, were beyond the power of these men to remedy or solve. Earlier than her neighbours, Britain enjoyed the fruits and endured the rigours of the Industrial Revolution. She gained a new domain of power and prosperity. At the same time, the growing masses in her ill-built towns were often plunged into squalor and misery, the source of numerous and well-grounded discontents. Her technical lead was due to the ingenuity and success of British inventors and men of business in the 18th century, and to the fortunate proximity of her main coal and iron deposits to each other and to the coast. Supremacy at sea, the resources of the colonial empire, and the use of capital accumulated from its trade nourished the industrial movement. Steam engines were gradually harnessed to the whole field of contemporary industry. In engineering, accurate tools were perfected, which brought a vast increase in output. The spinning of cotton was mechanized, and the factory system grew by degrees. The skilled man, self-employed, who'd hitherto worked in his home, was steadily displaced. Machinery, the rise of population, and extensive changes in employment all presented a formidable social problem. The government were, by their background and upbringing, largely unaware of the causes of the ills which they had to cure. They concentrated upon the one issue they understood, the defence of property. In a society which was rapidly becoming industrial, most of them represented the abiding landed interest. They were incapable of carrying out even moderate reforms because of their obsessive fears of bloody revolution. Napoleon had closed the continent to British commerce, and the answering British blockade had made things worse for industry at home. There was much unemployment in the industrial North and the Midlands. Smashing of machinery during the Luddite riots of 1812 and 1813 had exposed the complete absence of means of preserving public order. There was no coordination between the Home Office in London and the Justices of the Peace in the country. Disorder was in the end suppressed only by the tactful and efficient behaviour of the officers commanding the troops sent to put down the rioters. Often before, in the 18th century, low wages and lack of employment had caused widespread unrest, which had been fanned into riot whenever a succession of bad harvests drove prices high and made food dearer. Bad harvests now added to the prevailing distress. But 18th century riots were generally soon over. They were snuffed out by a few hangings and sentences of transportation to the colonies. The sawpates who remained at home were more inclined to blame nature for their woes than either the economic or political system. After Waterloo, the public temper was very different. Extremist radical leaders came out of hiding and kept up a perpetual and growing agitation. Their organizations, which had been suppressed during the French Revolution, now reappeared and began to take the shape of a political movement, though as yet scarcely represented in the House of Commons. In the radical view, it was the government alone, and not chance or act of God, that was to blame for the misfortunes of the people. The Tory cabinet, in the face of such charges, knew not what to do. It was no part of Tory philosophy to leave everything to be settled by the chaffer of the marketplace, to trust to good luck and ignore the bad. The Tories of the time recognised, and sometimes gloried, in the responsibility of the governing classes for the welfare of the whole nation. The tasks of government were well understood to be as Burke had defined them, the public peace, the public safety, the public order, the public prosperity. It was the last of these that was now foremost. The trouble was that the government, in the unprecedented conditions that confronted them, had no idea how to secure the public prosperity. And even if they'd hit upon a plan, they possessed no experienced body of civil servants to put it into effect. As a result, the only remedy for misery was private charity or the poor law. It was a misfortune for Britain in these years that parliamentary opposition was at its weakest. A generation in the wilderness had demoralised the Whig Party, which had not been effectively in office since 1783. Among themselves, the Whigs were deeply divided, and none of them had any better or broader plans for post-war reconstruction than the Tories. Indeed, their interests were essentially the same. Like their rivals, they represented the landed class, and also the City of London. The only issues upon which they seriously quarrelled with the government were Catholic emancipation and the enfranchisement of the middle classes in the rising industrial towns. In the 1790s, the Whigs had favoured the cause of parliamentary reform. It had been a useful stick with which to beat the administration of the younger Pitt. But they'd been badly scared by the headlong course of events in France. Their leaders only gradually and reluctantly regained their reforming zeal. In the meantime, as Hazlitt put it, the two parties were like competing stagecoaches which splashed each other with mud but went by the same road to the same place. The radicals who found their way into Parliament were too few to form an effective opposition. One of their veteran leaders, John Cartwright, had for 40 years, in a litter of pamphlets, been advocating annual parliaments and universal suffrage. He was a landed gentleman, liked by many members, but he never sat in the House of Commons. Under the unreformed franchise, no constituency would adopt him. The violence of language used by the radicals frightened Tories and Whigs alike. It stiffened the resistance of the upper middle classes, both industrial and landed, to all proposals for change. English political tradition centred in Parliament, and men still looked to Parliament to cure the evils of the day. If Parliament did nothing, then the structure of Parliament must be changed. Agitation therefore turned from airing social discontents to demanding parliamentary reform. Huge meetings were held, and protests vociferously made. But the tactics of the radicals were too much like those of the French revolutionaries to gain support from the middle classes. Though still denied much weight in Parliament, the middle classes were bound by their fear of revolution to side in the last resort with a landed interest. The cabinet was thoroughly perturbed. Habeas corpus was suspended, and legislation passed against the holding of seditious meetings. Throughout the country, a fresh wave of demonstrations followed. A large body of men set out to march from Manchester to London to present a petition against the government's measures, each carrying a blanket for his night's shelter. This march of the blanketeers disturbed the authorities profoundly. The leaders were arrested, and the rank and file quickly dispersed. Another rising in Derbyshire was easily suppressed. These alarums and excursions revealed the gravity of conditions. Not only was there grinding poverty among the working population, but also a deep-rooted conflict between the manufacturing and agricultural classes. The economy of the country was dangerously out of balance. The war debt had reached alarming proportions. The fundholders were worried at the instability of the national finances. The country had gone off the gold standard in 1797, and the paper currency had seriously depreciated. In 1812, a parliamentary committee advised returning to gold, but the Bank of England was strongly adverse, and nothing was done. The income tax, introduced by Pitt to finance the war, was highly unpopular, especially among the industrial middle class. It took 10% of all incomes over £150 a year, and there were lower rates for smaller incomes. The yield in 1815 was £15 million, which was a large proportion of the budget. Agriculture as well as industry quaked at the end of the war. Much capital had been sunk in land for the sake of high profits. Peace brought a slump in the prices fetched by crops, and landowners clamoured for protection against the importation of cheap foreign corn. This had been granted by the Corn Law of 1815, which excluded foreign wheat unless the domestic price per quarter rose above 80 shillings. The cost of bread went up, and the manufacturing classes had to raise wages to save their workers from hunger. The manufacturers, in their turn, got the income tax abolished, which helped them but imperiled the budget. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Nicholas van Sittart, struggled vainly with the chaos of a mounting deficit and an unstable currency, while behind these technical problems distress grew and gaped. In 1819, an incident took place which increased the unpopularity and quickened the fears of the government. A meeting of protest was held at St. Peter's Fields in mid-Manchester, attended by over 50,000 people, including women and children. The local magistrates lost their heads and, after reading the Riot Act, ordered the yeomanry to charge. 11 people were killed, 2 of them women, and 400 were injured. This massacre of Peterloo, as it was called in ironic reference to the Battle of Waterloo, aroused widespread indignation, which was swelled still further when the government took drastic steps to prevent the recurrence of disorder. 6 acts were passed regulating public meetings, empowering the magistrates to seize seditious literature, forbidding unauthorized drilling in military formations, imposing a heavy tax upon the press to restrict the circulation of radical newspapers, regulating the issue of warrants and the bringing of cases to trial. Soon afterwards, a conspiracy was discovered against the whole cabinet. A small gang of plotters was arrested in Cato Street, a turning off the Edgware Road, where they had met to plan to murder all the ministers at a dinner party and seize the Bank of England. The attack by the government upon the traditional principles of English liberty aroused the conscience of the Whigs. They considered that Peterloo was no excuse for invading the rights of the subject. They demanded an inquiry. Liberty was at stake, and this was a struggle they well understood. When they were outvoted, however, they took their defeat with some equanimity, for they were as frightened as the Tories by the social unrest that was gripping all Europe. Compared with most continental countries, Britain came lightly out of these years of disturbance. But the spectacle of convulsions abroad darkened counsel at home. By the end of 1819, trade and harvests had improved. A commission under the chairmanship of Robert Peel, a young Tory politician who'd been Chief Secretary for Ireland at the age of 24, recommended a return to the gold standard. Peel brought in and carried a bill embodying the principles of their report. Stabilisation of the currency was at last achieved, and by a private Member of Parliament. Though the landed interests suffered some hardship, not without raising their voices in complaint, it seemed that a corner had been turned. Once again in English history, the personal affairs of the royal family now exploded into public view. Victory over Napoleon had been a triumph for the divine right of kings and the cause of monarchy. But the republican influence of the French Revolution had left its mark on public opinion in most European countries, and the vices or incapacity of many monarchs made them easy targets for criticism and abuse. In England, King George III had long been intermittently mad, and English politicians had had to reckon with the virtual demise of the crown for considerable intervals. In 1788, the first madness of the king had confronted Pitt with a grave political crisis. An acrimonious dispute with Fox and the Whigs over the powers that should be exercised by the Prince of Wales as regent was brought to a conclusion only by George III's sudden recovery. In 1810, the old king finally sank into incurable imbecility. He lived for another 10 years, roaming the corridors of Windsor Castle with long white beard and purple dressing gown. The prince became regent with unrestricted royal prerogatives. To the consternation of his old Whig friends, he'd kept his Tory advisers in power and prosecuted the war with vigour. Whatever the faults of George IV, his determination as regent to support Wellington and Castlereagh and to stand up to Napoleon should earn him an honourable place in his country's history. The royal family of the House of Hanover had by now implanted itself firmly on English soil. Farmer George, as George III was called in his happier middle years, had become a popular figure. He'd been the only person who'd not lost his nerve at the time of the Gordon riots, when a crazy Protestant mob, led by an unbalanced member of the aristocracy, reduced London to panic. He had endured the disasters of the American War of Independence. But though he commanded his people's affection, he scarcely inspired their leaders' respect. He married a German princess, Queen Charlotte, who bore him a brood of sons, seven of whom grew to manhood. None of them added dignity or lustre to the royal house. The atmosphere of the court was like that of a minor German principality. All was stiff, narrow, fusty. The spirited lad, who was to be George IV, soon rebelled against his decorous mother and parsimonious father. A gift for facile friendship, often with dubious personages, alienated him still further from the home circle. He was early deprived of the companionship of his brothers, who were dispatched to Germany, there to receive a thorough Teutonic grounding. George, as heir to the throne, had to have an English background, and in the circle of his more intimate friends, Charles James Fox, Richard Sheridan, and Beau Brummel, he soon acquired the attributes of the 18th-century English gentleman, the arts of acquiring debts, of wearing fine clothes, and making good conversation. His natural intelligence and good taste went undisciplined, and his talent for self-expression was frequently squandered in melodramatic emotion. Self-indulgence warped his judgment, and frivolity marred his bearing. When pleasure clashed with royal duty, it was usually pleasure that won. The loneliness of his position, both as regent and king, cast a harsh emphasis upon his not unamiable weaknesses. In 1784, the prince had fallen in love. His choice was unfortunate. Maria Fitzherbert was not only a commoner of obscure family, but also a Roman Catholic. Her morals were impeccable, and she would be content with nothing less than marriage. The prince's Whig friends were alarmed when the heir to the most Protestant throne in Europe insisted on marrying a Roman Catholic widow who'd already survived two husbands. Under the Royal Marriages Act, the union was illegal, and George's behaviour was neither creditable to himself nor to his position. The clandestine beginnings of this relationship and the volatile temperament of George did their work. Mrs. Fitzherbert, prim and quiet, was not the woman to hold him for long. The relationship slid back into the secrecy from which it had unwillingly emerged. It was finally broken off, but not until some years after George had contracted a second, legal and dynastic marriage. At the bidding of his parents, in 1795, he was wedded to Caroline of Brunswick, a noisy, flighty, and unattractive German princess. George was so appalled at the sight of his bride that he was drunk for the first 24 hours of his married life. A few days after his wedding, he wrote his wife a letter absolving her from any further conjugal duties. For some years thereafter, he consoled himself with Lady Jersey. He acquired a growing hatred for Caroline. A high-spirited, warm-hearted girl was born of their brief union, Princess Charlotte, who found her mother quite as unsatisfactory as her father. In 1814, George banned his wife from court, and after an unseemly squabble, she left England for a European tour, vowing to return to plague her husband when he should accede to the throne. The government were perturbed about the problem of the succession. Princess Charlotte married Prince Leopold of Saxe-Coburg, later King of the Belgians, but in 1817 she died in childbirth. Her infant was stillborn. George's brothers, who were all in different ways eccentric, were thoroughly unpopular. As Wellington said, "The damnest millstone about the necks of any government. They have personally insulted two-thirds of the gentlemen of England." They lacked not only charm, but lawful issue. But they were well aware of the importance of their position. They had a cash value to the government on the royal marriage market. Most of them were already illegally involved in long-standing relationships with women. In 1818, however, the obliging Dukes of Clarence and Kent did their royal duty, for a sum. Kent made a German marriage and retired to Gibraltar to exercise his martial talents upon the rock. The offspring of this alliance was the future Queen Victoria. The Prince of Wales had long played with the idea of divorcing his itinerant wife, but Liverpool's government were apprehensive. The prince's extravagance, his lavish architectural experiments at Brighton and Windsor, were already causing them anxiety and giving rise to hostile speeches in Parliament. The Lord Chancellor, bluest of Tories, was vehemently opposed to any idea of divorce. The bench of bishops adopted a similar and suitable attitude. But George was persistent. He got a commission appointed to inquire into the princess's conduct. It posted to Italy to collect evidence from the unsavoury entourage of Caroline. In July 1819, the government received a report producing considerable circumstantial evidence against her. George was delighted. Liverpool and the cabinet, dismayed. Ever since 1714, the quarrels of the royal family had provided ammunition for party political warfare. The opposition would certainly take up the cause of the injured wife. The princess's chief legal adviser was Henry Broome, the ablest of the younger Whigs. This witty, ambitious, and unscrupulous attorney saw the value of the case to his party, though he was unconvinced of his client's innocence. He entered into confidential relations with the government, hoping for a compromise which would bring advancement to himself. But in January 1820, the mad old king died, and the position of the new sovereign's consort had to be determined. George IV fell seriously ill, but his hatred of Caroline sustained and promoted his recovery. He insisted upon her name being struck from the church liturgy. The cabinet presented him with a nervous note pointing out the difficulties of action. But now he was king. He warned them he would dismiss the lot and threatened to retire to Hanover. The Whigs were as much alarmed as the Tories by the king's determination. They too feared the effect on public opinion outside parliamentary and political circles. Whatever happened, there would be a scandal which would bring the monarchy into dangerous disrepute. Caroline now showed her hand. In April 1820, an open letter appeared in the London press, signed by her and recounting her woes. The radical sympathy of the City of London was easily aroused in her favour. Alderman Wood entered into active correspondence with her and promised her a warm reception. The radicals saw their chance of discrediting the traditional political parties. The government made a last effort. Broome was sent to intercept the Queen on her journey to England. A hurried meeting took place at Saint-Omer. But nothing would stop the infuriated woman, whose obstinacy was inflamed by radical advice. In June she landed, and she drove amid stormy scenes of enthusiasm from Dover to London. Her carriage was hauled most of the way by exuberant supporters. Her arrival produced a tumult of agitation. The government reluctantly decided that they must go through with the business. A secret committee of the Lords was set up, and the report persuaded Liverpool to agree to introduce a bill of pains and penalties if the Queen were proved guilty of adultery. Popular feeling against the conditions of England was now diverted into a national inquiry into the condition of the monarchy. The characters of the royal personages concerned came under merciless scrutiny. A well-organized campaign was launched on behalf of Queen Caroline, led by the city radicals, and, now that there was no turning back, by Broome. Cheering crowds gathered every day outside her house in London. Her appearance in public places was loudly acclaimed. Politicians known to oppose her case were stoned in their carriages. In July, the hearing of the charges was opened in Westminster Hall. In lengthy sessions, the Attorney General put the case for the government, producing unreliable Italian witnesses from Caroline's vagabond court. Her master of ceremonies, Bergami, had installed his numerous relations with bogus titles around her person, and this motley company had for some years been touring the Mediterranean countries, earning derision and insults from several governments. The conflicting and sordid evidence of lackeys and chambermaids was displayed before the audience in Westminster Hall. Stories of keyholes, of indecorous costumes and gestures, regaled the public ear. The London press openly attacked the credibility of the witnesses with their broken Italianate English and their uninspiring appearance. Leigh Hunt wrote a pungent verse. "You swear, you swear, oh, signore, si, that through a double door, eh, you've seen her think adulterously? Ver trusa, si, signore." For 15 days, wrote a contemporary historian, the whole people was obscene. Broome led the defence. With great effect, he produced George's letter of 1796, absolving his wife from all marital obligations. It was not difficult to show that the conflicting evidence produced hardly justified the divorce clause in the Bill of Pains and Penalties. He boldly attacked the veiled personage behind the case, the king himself, malevolently referring to George's obesity in a wounding quotation from Paradise Lost. The other shape, if shape it could be called, that shape had none distinguishable in member, joint, or limb. Or substance might be called that shadow seemed, for each seemed either. What seemed its head, the likeness of a kingly crown had on. The peers thought the Queen guilty, but doubted the wisdom of divorce, and the bill passed through their house by only 9 votes. The Whigs, when compromise had become impossible, voted against the government. Their leader, Earl Grey, had declared his belief in the innocence of Caroline. The Cabinet now decided that there was small chance of forcing the bill through the Commons. They withdrew it, and the affair was dropped. The London mob rioted in joy. The whole city was illuminated. The windows of the ministers' houses were broken. Lord Sidmouth, who'd prudently kept the newspapers from his daughters, was the first to suffer. But the bubbling effervescence of the masses quickly subsided. Caroline was granted an annuity of £50,000, which she was not too proud to accept. One political result of the crisis was the resignation of George Canning, who'd been on friendly terms with the Queen. This gifted pupil of Pitt had rejoined the administration in 1816 as president of the Board of Control, which supervised the government of India. He'd made his influence felt in other spheres as well, and his departure was a serious loss to the cabinet. 2 more awkward scenes closed this regrettable story. In July 1821, George IV was crowned in pomp at Westminster Abbey. Caroline attempted to force her way into the abbey, but was turned away because she had no ticket. A month later, she died. An attempt by the authorities to smuggle her coffin out of the country was frustrated, and a triumphant and tumultuous funeral procession struggled through the city of London. This was the last victory the Radicals gained from the affair. The agitation of the Queen had been essentially the expression of discontent. It marked the highest point of the radical movement in these post-war years. Towards the end of 1820, however, industry and trade revived and popular disturbances subsided. The mass of the country was instinctively royalist, and the personal defects of the sovereign had little effect upon this deep-rooted tradition. The monarchy was inseparable from the settlement of 1688. Canning himself had underrated the nation's deep conservatism. The Duke of Bedford had at one moment so far lost his nerve in the crisis as to declare, "The monarchy is finished!" Eldon showed better judgment. "The lower orders here are all Queen's folks. Few of the middling or higher orders are, except the profligate, or those who are endeavouring to acquire power through mischief. There is certainly an inclination to disquiet among the lower orders, but it is so well watched that there is no great cause for uneasiness on that account." The political effects of the episode did not end at Canning's resignation. The Tory administration, which consisted largely of ageing reactionaries, had been gravely weakened. It was isolated from general opinion and badly in need of new recruits. The Whigs, too, had been forced to recognise their lack of popular backing, and the younger members saw that the old and natural alliance between the Whigs and the people was now in danger. They began henceforth to renew their interest in parliamentary reform, which soon became the question of the hour. Chapter 2. Canning and the Duke. During the 10 years' reign of King George IV, the old party groupings in politics were fast dissolving. For more than a century, Whig and Tory, on different contentious issues, had faced and fought one another in the House of Commons. Whig also fought Whig. Modern scholars, delving deeply into family connections and commercial interests, have sought to show that there was no such thing as a two-party system in 18th-century Britain. If caution must be the hallmark of history, all that may be said is that the men in power were vigorously opposed by the men who were out, while in between stood large numbers of neutral-minded gentlemen, placidly prepared to support whichever group held office. It is not much of a conclusion to come to about a great age of parliamentary debate. The ins and outs might as well have names, and why not employ the names of Whig and Tory, which their supporters cast at one another? At any rate, in the 1820s, a government of Tory complexion had been in power almost without interruption for 30 years. This government had successfully piloted the country through the longest and most dangerous war in which Britain had yet been engaged. It had also survived, though with tarnishing reputation, 5 years of peacetime unrest. But the Industrial Revolution posed a set of technical administrative problems which no aristocratic and agricultural party, Whig or Tory, was capable of handling. The 19th century called for a fresh interpretation of the duties of government. New principles and doctrines were arising which were to break up the old political parties, and in the Victorian age reshape and recreate them. These developments took time, but already the party built up by the younger Pitt was feeling their stir and stress. Pitt had enlisted the growing mercantile and commercial interests of his day on the Tory side, and his policy of free trade and efficient administration had won over leaders of industry, such as the fathers of Robert Peel and William Gladstone. But Pitt's tradition had faded during the years of war. Faithful disciples among the younger men strove to carry on his ideas, but his successors in office lacked his prestige and broad vision. Without skilful management, an alliance between the landed gentry and the new merchant class was bound to collapse. The growers of corn and the employers of industrial labour had little in common, and they began to quarrel while Pitt was still alive. Disruption was postponed to the days of Peel, but the conflict had been sharpening since the end of the war amid falling agricultural prices and weary bickering over the corn laws. Caroline's divorce had discredited and weakened the government. Parties were not yet expected to work out and lay before the country ambitious programmes of action. But even to its friends, Lord Liverpool's administration seemed to have no aim or purpose beyond preserving existing institutions. The younger Tories, headed by George Canning and supported by William Huskisson, spokesman of the merchants, advocated a return to Pitt's policy of free trade and intelligent commercial legislation. But even they were disunited. The issue of Catholic emancipation was soon to confuse and split the Tory party, and on this they were opposed by one of their own generation. Robert Peel, during his 6 years in Ireland, had successfully upheld the English ascendancy against heavy discontent and smouldering rebellion. He believed that an honest, despotic government would be by far the fittest for Ireland. By a mixture of coercion and adroit patronage, he had imposed comparative quiet and orderliness. In the nature of things, neither his methods nor their results endeared him to the Irish. He'd come home convinced that Catholic emancipation would imperil not only Protestantism in Ireland, but the entire political system at Westminster. Long before the 19th century was over, events proved him right. Meanwhile, Peel became Canning's rival for the future leadership of the Tories. Personalities added their complications. Canning had played a leading part in the conception and launching of the Peninsular War. His chief interest lay in foreign affairs. But this field seemed barred to him by his quarrel with Castlereagh. The older members distrusted him. Brilliant, witty, effervescent, he had a gift for sarcasm which made him many enemies. A legend of unreliability grew up. His seniors thought him an intriguer, and when he resigned over the royal divorce in 1820, a Tory lord declared with relish, "Now we've got rid of those confounded men of genius." In August 1822, Canning was offered the post of Governor-General of India. He reconciled himself to this honourable exile. His political life seemed at an end. But then fate took a hand. In August, while he was waiting to take up his post in the East, Castlereagh, his mind unhinged by overwork, cut his throat in the dressing room of his home. Canning's presence in the government was now essential. He was appointed Foreign Secretary, and in this office he dominated English politics until his death 5 years later. The ministry had recently been joined by Peel at the Home Office, and now Huskisson went to the Board of Trade. The government thus had as many as three leading members in the Commons. In 1815, three-quarters of the cabinet had been in the Lords. The following years saw a more enlightened period of Tory rule. Canning, Peel, and Huskisson pursued bold policies which in many respects were in advance of those propounded by the Whigs. The penal code was reformed by Peel, and the London police force is his creation. Huskisson overhauled the tariff system and continued Pitt's work in abolishing uneconomic taxes and revising the customs duties. Canning urged a scaling down of the duty on corn as the price rose at home. This was bound to bring conflict in the Tory ranks. He realised the distress and the political danger it would cause in the country, and declared on one occasion, "We are on the brink of a great struggle between property and population. Such a struggle is only to be averted by the mildest and most liberal legislation." This soothing task he set before himself, but it was Peel who had to face the crisis when it came. Annual motions for a bill of Catholic emancipation were brought in, to the disquiet of the reactionary supporters of the government. But on one issue, Canning was firm. He was a stubborn defender of the existing franchise. He believed that by far-sighted commercial measures and a popular foreign policy, the problems of parliamentary reform could be evaded. Length of years was not given him in which to perceive himself mistaken. A crisis in Spain confronted Canning with his first task as Foreign Secretary. The popular elements which had led the struggle against Napoleon now revolted against the autocratic Bourbon government, formed a revolutionary junta, and proclaimed a constitution on the model of that set up in France in 1815. Canning had backed the Spanish national rising in 1808 and was naturally sympathetic. But Metternich and the Holy Alliance saw the revolt, which soon spread to the Bourbon Kingdom of Naples, as a threat to the principle of monarchy and to the entire European system. A congress at Verona in the autumn of 1822 discussed intervention in Spain on behalf of the Bourbons. Wellington had gone out as British representative with instructions from Castlereagh that Britain was to play no part in such a move. Canning vehemently agreed with this view and gave it wide publicity in England, and indeed the whole tradition of British foreign politics was against intervention in the domestic affairs of other states. But Austria and Russia were determined to act. An instrument lay ready to their hand. The ex-enemy, France, coveted respectability. Her restored Bourbon government feared the revolutionaries and offered to send a military expedition to Spain to recover for King Ferdinand his absolutist powers. This was accepted at Verona. Canning would have nothing to do with it. There was great excitement in London. English volunteers went to Spain to serve in the defence forces of the Spanish Liberals, a name which entered English politics from this Spanish revolt, while Conservative came to us from France. But Canning was equally against official intervention on the side of Spanish liberalism, and it was upon this that the Whigs attacked him. These heart-searchings in Britain made little difference to the outcome in Spain. The French expedition met with no serious resistance, and the Spanish liberals retired to Cadiz and gave in. A much larger issue now loomed beyond the European scene. Britain had little direct interest in the constitution of Spain, but for two centuries she'd competed for the trade of Spain's colonies in South America. Their liberties were important to her. During the wars with Napoleon, these colonies had enjoyed the taste of autonomy. They had no relish, when the Bourbons were restored in Madrid, for the revival of royal Spanish rule. Up and down the whole length of the Andes, campaigns were fought for South American liberation. By Canning's time at the Foreign Office, most of the republics that now figure on the map had come into separate, if unstable, existence. In the meanwhile, British commerce with these regions had trebled in value since 1814. If France or the Holy Alliance intervened in the New World, if European troops were sent across the Atlantic to subdue the rebels, all this was lost, and much besides. These dangers gave Canning great anxiety. The business elements in England, whose support he was keen to command, were acutely sensitive to the peril. He acted with decision. He urged the United States to join Britain in opposing European interference in the countries across the Atlantic. While the Americans meditated on this proposal, Canning also made an approach to the French. France had no desire to start an overseas quarrel with Britain. She disclaimed the use of force in South America and forswore colonial ambitions there. Thus was the Holy Alliance checked. As Canning later declared in a triumphant phrase, he had called the New World into existence to redress the balance of the old. The New World, meanwhile, had something of its own to say. The United States had no wish to see European quarrels transferred across the ocean. They'd already recognized the independence of the principal Latin American republics. They did not want aspiring princes of the royal houses of Europe to be ferried over and set up as monarchs on the democratic continent. Still less would they contemplate European reconquest and